contributing their time to kind of speak to us on what I think is a very important topic in our community and in society as a whole. So we very much look forward to your presentation tonight. I'll turn it over to you.
Okay.
So the good doctor drew the first straw.
The short,
the long one.
All right. Okay. So I guess as Rabbi Volka is slowly stealing each of the pens that I brought it for the audience, and apparently my cue cards.
It says Jewish education through Torah. That's your business. That's pretty
that
good.
That is my business.
Okay.
So anyways, it's a pleasure to be here today. It's wonderful to be able to come and talk about two very important aspects of my life, my Judaism and my profession, being a clinical psychologist. So just as a way of a brief update on what I do, I've been in Ottawa via the United States, originally from Chamonix, but I studied out in the States, Detroit and in Ohio. And I'm a clinical psychologist. I've worked for 18 years at the CHIA, 15 of those years on the inpatient unit, where the primary thing that I did in addition to other psychological services was to help figure out diagnoses when there were complicated diagnoses and people coming in to the inpatient unit. Currently at CHIO, I now work on the outpatient service, and I'm both the psychologist and the clinical lead for outpatient mental health at CHIO. And that entire time, I've also been the clinical director of my own group practice in the community. And in that time, I've had an opportunity to work with people across all different cultural backgrounds, and including people from various different levels of observance through the Jewish community as well. What was really exciting about today was to be able to talk a little bit about mental health within the Jewish community, and maybe think together about some interesting circumstances that might be unique within our community. We'll see if we get there. The idea is that we would each take a few minutes to talk, and then we would talk to each other. We didn't know there would be a table separating us to keep us safe. And then what I was hoping to do is also for us to open it up that if you had any questions for us to address. And usually when I do these sorts of things, there are two ways we can do that. People can raise their hand and ask questions. But another option and opportunity is to also hand out these nifty cue cards. So if there are questions that you really want to ask but aren't sure you want to say it out loud, you can write it out. Ergo, what used to be more pens, now fewer pens are here. I'm just kidding. Don't make two. So if I can just have you pass out the cards and pass around some pens. So, for my part to begin, I want to talk for a moment about a couple of key points related to mental health. Okay. So when we're talking about mental illness or struggles with mental health, I like to think of it on a continuum. Okay. So whenever I see someone who is struggling with something, typically it is a variation on something we might see that's quite normal. So for example, when people are dealing with anxiety, well, anxiety is an incredibly important thing. We don't want to get rid of anxiety. Anxiety is our alarm bell. It tells us when there's danger. It's the thing that tells us we're driving too close to the cliff, get your car back on the road, right? However, when anxiety starts firing and ringing that bell indiscriminately, or it starts ringing it for things that we really shouldn't be anxious about and starts to affect our functioning, our happiness, our ability to accomplish things, then it's a problem. sadness. Sadness draws people in. When we're struggling, it's a very important way of communicating to others that we need our community or we need our family to come in close. It's also in many ways an honor to feel sad, for example, when you've lost someone that you care about. It's a real expression of that loss. But sadness to the extreme keeps us in our beds, makes it difficult for us to be able to concentrate or attend, and can really be debilitating. Anger is remarkable. I love anger, right? Anger is one of the energizing forces in passion. When you have people that are angry about an injustice, it's what motivates movements and guides change. But in the wrong direction, it can lead to violence and aggression. And we could go on and on about the different things that are along this continuum, but when it starts to affect functioning and happiness, that's when it becomes important to start to take another look at it. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that what we take with us into any given situation is incredibly important, and it affects us. What we take with us are our history of experiences, the things that have impacted us that we bring into a situation. The other thing is our wiring. We're all wired differently. Some of us feel strong, it lasts long. Some of us don't feel that strong. Some of us, when we feel things, we might feel things about certain things that we take as an insult, and other things we don't. Okay, so we're wired differently. And what we bring with us affects us. So when I was thinking about all this, I was also thinking, well, what do we bring with us as Jewish people? Okay? It may not, you know, nothing is true for everybody. But when I think about the history that we have together, the way we've been treated, when I think about us as a minority group in a majority culture, that brings something. And it reminds me of a story that I wanted to share before I move into something else. And that is, when I was studying in Detroit, I was in a developmental PhD program before I moved into a clinical program. I was asked to introduce a speaker that was coming into the community by Hillel. And so I had the honor to meet and introduce Rabbi Abraham Twersky when he was talking in the community in Detroit. And as a part of that, I was asked to actually pick him up. He was staying at a family's house in the suburbs, and bring him to the location before I introduced him. And so out of respect, I don't typically walk around wearing a kippah. And I decided to wear a kippah if I was going to pick him up. And so I got into my car and I drove to him, and like today, I was early. Okay? And so I had to waste some time before I was going to go pick him up. And so I wanted to get some gum, so I figured I'd stop at a convenience store. And just as I was about to get out of the car, I realized I was still wearing my kippah. And I was in a neighborhood that I didn't recognize. And I immediately felt something that I didn't typically feel. I was anxious. I wasn't sure, am I safe in this neighborhood to walk out wearing a kippah and identify myself as a Jewish person? Now, I want you to know that I had been teaching for years, undergraduate classes, and there isn't a time that my Judaism doesn't get woven into the class. But when I introduce myself as a Jewish person, I'm making the choice. And here, I was about to step out, and I wouldn't have the choice of who I introduced myself to, everybody would see, right? I will tell you that I didn't take the kippah off. I did go in, I got the gun, there was no incident, everybody was fine, and you know, that might have been in my head. But what was interesting to me was that I didn't realize the insecurity that was lurking below on what will happen if I step out and people just know I'm Jewish. And so it's very interesting. And I think that's one of the things that I might bring with me when I'm walking out into the world. The reason that's really important is we have a certain amount of space for the things that we carry around with us. And the more space that's taken up by certain concerns and worries and anxieties, the less space we have for the stresses that are going to impact us, the surprise stresses, the day-to-day stresses. So it becomes very important to make sure that we're always cleaning out and being aware of the things that we carry with us, because that will give us more of an ability to handle the stresses that we face. The last thing that I'll say, then turn it over to you, just to make the comment, you may all be familiar with the famous saying of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, that life is a narrow bridge. And I'm paraphrasing here when I say, and one of our main jobs is not to panic. And I thought that was brilliant. It's a narrow bridge, don't panic. On that note, I'll turn it over.
Thank you very much. I don't know how many people were on the bridge that you shouldn't panic, but thank you. Thank you very much, Doctor. I have the great pleasure of seeing the good doctor every Shabbat, and he always comes over afterwards, and we have some sort of a psychological schmooze, a 5-minute schmooze. So first of all, mazel tov to the Shapses on a new grandchild, a granddaughter.
Mazel tov to Rabbi Volga and Leah on a new great-grandchild.
Right, thank you very much. Okay, we're good. The other thing you may not be aware, we just came from City Hall. There was the launch of the book by Cantor Kraus. Izzy was there taking pictures. Yeah, so that may be, I don't know how many of them will carry over here, but there's lots of competition tonight. All right, the only good thing is that the Blue Jays are not competition, so that's good. So when the good doctor and I talked about how we would address the first part, which is the presentation, so the good doctor did the sort of like a general overview, and I thought that I'd share a few insights into where Judaism psychology meet in actual practice. Not so much in the big picture of the anxieties that come from being Jewish, but more in terms of what it is about being Jewish that addresses the question of psychological health. So in the beginning of all of this, I think it's important for us to know that Judaism, and I would say Judaism is a code word that I'm not even comfortable with. I want to say the faith that we live, that's basically grounded in the Torah, that there's a clear mandate that we have to live, and we have to live well, and we have to live happily. Not that this is the end of everything, but that it's absolutely necessary in order for us to appreciate, to wake up every morning and to say, thank God for restoring my soul. It almost implies that you're happy that you're here. And you would be surprised that there are a multitude of directives in the Torah that tell us that you have to be happy. Now, it's very easy to tell people that you have to be happy, but if they're sad, how do you tell them you're well? There's a mitzvah to be happy, so what right do you have to be sad? It doesn't work that way. It starts off with a very simple idea, and you can't divorce these things, because when you try to do so, you get a distortion of Judaism. We start with a basic belief in God. A belief in God means that we didn't come here by accident, we were created. The fact that we're created by God means that God wants us here. So whenever you hear about people doubting whether, you know, God wants them, God likes them, or whatever the case may be, whether this answer works well in a psychological clinic is a different story, but very simply, the fact that you are here means that God wants you here. And if God wants you here, you should be happy with yourself, because that's the affirmation that you are okay. And then you get on the other side of it, which is that we have lots of trials and tribulations in life. That's not easy. And the question that many people ask is, what's it all about and what's it for and is it worth it and should I go through the struggle and do I have to really, you know, do I have to worry about wearing a kippah going to buy bubble gum in a store? Or maybe I'll just, you know, forget about it altogether. So there's, on the other hand, there's this construct within Judaism, which I know that maybe 50 or 60 years ago people would have been a little bit less happy talking about, and that's afterlife. And the fact that there is something beyond. And the idea that even if we may have doubts about the worthwhileness of everything that we're doing in this world, and you know, it sounds almost sacrilegious for us to talk about it in these terms when our ancestors, especially in the past generation or two, they really could have and did ask this question, which is it worth going through all of this that we're going through, murder of 6 million, and even people in Israel now are going through all of these trials and tribulations, what's it all about? Without the notion that ultimately we will have an answer to it, even if we don't know what the answer is right now, is absolutely essential. I don't think that anybody could really come up with a justifiable argument for a life in this world that is, you know, not that is not connected to something beyond. Because there are a lot of things that happen in this world that don't make sense to us, and we have an obligation to try to make sense out of them. So those are sort of the two bookends within which we travel. Now, inside that, there are so many fascinating legislations that we have. I share with you an observation that was once attributed to the Gaon of Vilna. When he was remarking on some of the complicated obligations that we have. So if you ask somebody what's the most complicated, one of them would say, well, you know, having to get up every morning and put on tefillin, that's pretty hard. Blocking out the entire world on Shabbat, that's very hard. Having to resist the smells of all those stores that emanate with their burgers and schmurgers and not eating them, that's hard. And there are all sorts of interesting challenges. But he remarked that the most difficult mitzvah that we have is v'samachta b'chagecha. That's to say, to rejoice in your holy day. It's actually a mandate from God that on times like Sukkot and Pesach and Shavuot, that we have to rejoice, which he understood this to mean that in that time you're not allowed to be sad even for a second. That this was the way, this was fulfillment, that yeah, there are other times that you have distractions, you have things that get you down, but then poof, nothing. You're not allowed to, and so can anybody really do this? It sounds almost like superhuman. And I can understand that people have difficulties, but look at what happens, for example, with something like sitting shiva. So we are all tuned into the idea that, God forbid, if we should lose a loved one, that we have an obligation to sit shiva. Shiva then meets up with Sukkot, the shiva is cancelled. Mm-hmm. Shiva meets with Pesach, shiva is cancelled. The same thing if it meets up with Yom Kippur. Which, by the way, leads to another very interesting obligation. In the Torah, there is no sad day. Even Yom Kippur, which probably was the closest to, there still is an obligation to rejoice on Yom Kippur. Now, you tell that to people today, they say, this doesn't even make sense, because they think of it very solemn. It is solemn, it's serious, but it's happy too. It's a Yom Tov. And the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Just like every other Yom Tov cancels the Shiva, Yom Kippur does too, and so does Rosh Hashanah. So we have no problem juxtaposing and correlating seriousness with joy. You can be seriously happy. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons, arguably, I'm venturing here into a little bit of speculation, one of the reasons why the sages instituted the idea of breaking a glass at a chuppah, I know we think of it in terms of the remembrance of Jerusalem. The Talmudic evidence is a little bit different. It was where they saw people getting a little bit out of, too rambunctious at a wedding. They basically took a very expensive crystal and smashed it on the dance floor, as if to wake people up and say, listen, folks, It's important to be happy, but you got to be seriously happy, not drunk and happy. There's a big difference between the two. In other words, have it in the right measure. One where you wake up the next day and you say, yes, I remember what I did yesterday. So we take the obligation to be happy, to rejoice. It's a very serious obligation. And it's there all over the place. But in order to allow for enough questions, I just want to leave you with something about how we all have an obligation to enhance the well-being of others. This is something that I've talked about over the years, and I'm sure Rabbi Schatz will not mind a little bit of a, for me it's a little bit of a rerun, but I don't mind rerunning this all the time. In all of the debates that you have about what are the essentials of Judaism, the one that sticks out amongst us is the idea of Ve'ahavta lo'reacha kamocha, that is to say that you should love your fellow like you love yourself. And we've gone through many we have gone through many hoops trying to figure out what this means, because it's a nice pie in the sky legislation. And if there's anything you learn very quickly about anything in the Torah, there's nothing pie in the sky about it. It has to have immediate and impactful application. So how do you fulfill the obligation to love everyone else without spending all of your excess money or even your immediate money? So Rambam in Hilchot Deyot has a very wonderful an answer to this question. He says, if you really love your fellow, what you will do is compliment that fellow, say nice things to that fellow, make that fellow feel good. Now you step back a little bit, you say, who in heaven's name would have ever come up with that type of an explanation? But the idea that Rambam is saying is that I get this. Long before the psychology of self-esteem, this was something which you would call a self-evident truth. You tell someone nice things about themselves, they feel good about themselves. They feel good about themselves, they're energized to do good and to share with others. You say nasty things to them, they feel badly about themselves, they can go into a depression because of it, they can reluctantly do everything that they're doing because they have to, but they're not with the same gusto. So if you love someone, Rambam says, what you got to do is make them feel good about themselves. And I know people may not think about it in these terms, but to understand that to boost other people's self-esteem and thinking about how they feel about themselves being the way that you fulfill the prototypical mitzvah of the Torah tells you a lot about how we are concerned about the welfare of others, the psychological equilibrium of others, and how, and this is the most important thing, each one of us is a potential therapist in that regard. Not as good as Dr. Neil, and not going into the weeds, but in terms of the day-to-day, to help everyone feel better, and therefore do better, it's all our obligation. Okay, you're ready for...
I am ready.
Go for it.
Some of the things that you said, So let's make it interesting. So you said something about not being allowed to be sad even for a second. I wonder about the kind of pressure that puts on people when there are legitimate reasons to be sad, when someone has a chemical imbalance that leads to depression or has had a series of events that make them depressed. And it's not something that they want, and they want to be able to get rid of it. And yet the message is that, you know, if they're hearing you shouldn't be sad, what does that do in terms of their ability to come and seek help and to feel respected in the Jewish community?
Good question.
I have a few.
Okay, so... This gets back, and actually you were very kind, because you could actually ask that about almost every single obligation that a person, let's say, is not feeling well, doesn't feel like getting up in the morning to go to prayers, to daven, you know, it's all part of it. So we have to be very careful and it's good that you asked this question, about being what you would call impositional. It's one thing to set up a target and to say this is the ideal. It's another to say you don't hit the target, there's something wrong with you. And this is where we begin with a very simple idea that they're aspirational mitzvot. That is to say, we're doing, I would make a differentiation between what you would call, we call them positive and negative, I hate those terminologies, say obligations and prohibitions. So the prohibitions really, no matter what, you shouldn't be insulting people. No matter what, you shouldn't be doing nasty things, you shouldn't be behaving, you shouldn't be stealing and that. The aspirational ones, which you call the obligations, there's no end to what you can do. You take a simple little thing like honoring your parents. So it's always bad to disrespect them. But on the other hand, to say to someone, well, they goofed one time and they accidentally said something that they shouldn't have. It's not as if we're trying to open up the floodgates and say, we understand everything that you do, but just to say, these are the things we should aspire for, to do our best and continue to do better and better day in, day out. In the specific issue of the obligation to be happy, we recognize that it's almost impossible to be happy all the time. But it's an aspirational thing. In other words, it's not like saying when you come into the Yom Tov, try to detach yourself from everything. It's almost like saying, you know, when I'm going on vacation, I'm going to forget work. So what happens if during the course of their vacation, some or other, they spy a email on their computer, which has to do with work, and they say, oh God, you know, I said I was going to be away from this, and here I am. So it happens all the time that we have the best of intentions, but then we land up lapsing, not because we want to. So we realize that in our humanity, we have these aspirations, but we also have our limitations, so we continue to try to do our best. And where it gets dangerous, and I admit to you that that's a little bit of a difficult one, is where it's wrongly interpreted that if you're not 100%, then you're not good at all. And that's something that we should never impart, because no one is perfect. And to say this is just, let's say, an aspirational goal, if we can reach that, that would be great. But it doesn't mean that we're going to, but just, you know, to have this in mind, that this is, the idea behind the Yom Tov is basically to detach from the things that normally get you down. The hardest one is telling someone not to grieve when you have a fresh wound. Even worse than a shiva being curtailed is a situation where wherein a person, where the death occurred too close to the Yom Tov to actually have the funeral, in which case everything is on hold until after the Yom Tov, before the shiva actually starts. That is, in terms of how do I juxtapose that with those obligations, that's really, in degree of difficulty, probably astronomical.
I'm concerned about the message. So, not allowed to be sad.
I'm happy for you
to change it, but I wrote it down.
But it means not allowed to be sad in the sense that, ideally, during the Yom Tov, when we're told that you should be rejoicing, it doesn't mean rejoicing for 50% of the time. Mm-hmm. It means rejoicing for 100% of the time, right? So I would accent and accentuate the positive in this rather than the negative. Recognizing full well that people can say, hold it, there was one moment during Yom Tov when I was upset because the food wasn't cooked well.
Right. And that's a good reason to be upset. But I guess one of the things that I really want to express out there is that I can't imagine anywhere where the idea of aspiring for a happy life wouldn't be the goal. Like it makes sense whether you're within a religious circle or not.
Oh, but this is not the goal. It's the means. Right. So it's a big
fair
difference.
Enough. Right. Fair okay. enough. Right. So, but when I'm thinking from my perspective, coming in as a psychologist,
okay, got it. Right.
Aspiring to have a happy life is an important thing for a lot of people. Okay, and when they find themselves in a difficult spot, be it because of life circumstances or other reasons, such as chemical imbalances or whatever, to be faced with potential messages that that takes away, for example, from you being able to be joyful in your experience of God. There's some literature, certainly more so, I think, within the ultra-Orthodox community, that talks about it as a sin, uses the language of sin, to not be joyful. And that creates an enormous pressure, whatever the motivation is. My guess would be in modern day, the rabbis in all the communities would be quite responsive to people that are struggling and wanting to support. And in fact, when I was recently in Brooklyn, I had an opportunity to speak with a therapist who was at the same seminar that I was at, who worked very closely as a therapist for people in that community. And so certainly there's what we've seen is a lot of support within the various communities, the various ultra-Orthodox and Orthodox communities, that wasn't maybe as accepted many years ago. Now there's more of an understanding about the value of maybe mental health services. The thing that I found really interesting is and please correct me, you're the expert on this without question, but when we look at the Code of Jewish Law, there's an interesting piece about when you're choosing a teacher, that teacher should be a God-fearing person. But when you're seeking medical support, that should be a qualified professional. Regardless of, I mean, it'd be nice if it was a God-fearing person, but you are obligated to seek someone who's a competent professional. And so when it comes to mental health, the interesting issue is whether a psychologist is considered a teacher or someone providing medical support and medical services.
So that's an interesting observation. So, for a teacher, we say, Malach Hashem Tzavokos, we ideally should seek a teacher who is of angelic qualities, right? Maybe difficult to find, but you have to, but you know, there are lots of them in Ottawa. We have lots that are like that. With regard to psychologists, there's actually a raging debate that has been going on for years about what type of psychologist one should choose. And there are still today, you will find rabbis who will say to their constituents, don't go to a psychologist, because they still have the idea that psychologists in the atmosphere of the Freudian era and afterwards, they're anti-God. And there is this fear that the psychologist will lead them off the track, which is, has it happened? Have I seen this happen? No, because in the end, I think what prevails is that people do seek out those that can solve whatever issues there are the best, right? And I don't really think that I've seen a good psychologist who would impose an anti-God feeling on anyone,
and in effect, you would be in contravention of your license.
Absolutely,
with
yeah.
the college.
Right, yeah, right. So you got to be that the value stop
be,
at the gate. Right.
Yeah, the ethical. You know, so when I'm right. working with people from atheists to Muslim to whatever, when I step into that room, I need to think about their life within their community,
100%.
And their services.
Right.
And
which is why I've never had any, whenever I've been asked, you know, to recommend a psychologist for someone, I always look for the best, rather than, you know, measuring them. Because again, this we treat this as the same way as we treat, let's say, if somebody has internal issues medically, you go to the best doctor you can get. There's no difference here either. So I hope that clears that up. When you did talk about this issue of people who have chemical situations, the one thing that I should emphasize before we even get deeper into it is that all bets are off when a person is in a situation where they don't have control any more than you would have other physical challenges that make it, let's say, difficult for a person to fulfill any obligation, right? So we would never say to an individual, let's say, because they have continence problems and they therefore cannot pray or some other. There's so many other issues. Generally, a dietetic person can't fast on Yom Kippur.
But that's where mental health is different, right?
Yeah.
Because mental health is, you know, you don't always have the blood test that tells you that there's a clear medical issue, or you don't
right.
have, so you don't have that evidence, because that tends to be more silent. It becomes open to interpretation, where people may say, well, that's not a chemical imbalance, you just need to toughen up. Right, and that's where it can be.
Well, it's a little tricky, right? But you can do that with all sorts of things, for example, a guy who gets a lot of headaches, you know. So maybe it's because you're drinking too much coffee or something like that. I don't know.
True.
Yeah. So, but we always err on the side of doing what it takes to get a person well. And if there's ever a doubt, this is where we would always err on the side of, let's do whatever we can to clear up the situation.
I have another question for you. I wonder if you can speak to. I know we had started to talk about this at shul, and because within Judaism, there some of the interesting things I think to think about. For example, if someone has a thought disorder, such as a developing psychotic illness. That is certainly one of the questions. I'm just going to throw a few at you. There's one of the questions is, so that person studying Kabbalah, for example, might actually be dangerous, right? It might in a mind that struggles with reality testing, that could be taken to a very different level. Or someone who, and this is the one we talked about, who has a predisposition to obsessive compulsive disorder. And the ritualized nature of Judaism. I wonder if you can speak to that. I wonder if I can also ask if someone can collect the cards that people
yeah.
have written on.
Right, so those are, I begin with this, as we say in humility, we probably won't be able to, we can't solve all situations. For example, I remember a situation of someone who had this compulsion about cleanliness, and when it came, for example, to eating a meal, so every time they would wash their hands before they would eat, they would then have to go back and wash again because they were afraid they didn't do a good job the first time.
Right.
It's interesting that I remember one situation where I spoke to this individual, and I asked them why they were doing it, and they explained this to me, and I sort of played a little bit of a rabbinic trick on them by saying to them, the idea of you washing your hands is not so that it should be clean. It's just preparatory for the exercise of sanctifying the act of eating. So that was like a mind-blowing thing to them, and slowly but surely get disengaged from that. A lot of times things happen because they're misinterpreted, they're enlarged beyond proportion. Thank you very much. I don't know so that was one that you asked. What was the other part of the question? Want to make sure that I don't avoid it.
Well, just I know that when we were talking at synagogue,
this was, by the way, after the conclusion of the prayers. After the conclusion of the davening. We never prayed during. It was after.
It wasn't
right. Yes.
Absolutely. You had talked about that as being something that has come across at times from congregants or from your experience. of people that took, for example, the joy of Judaism and performing the rituals, and it became something that it became very hard on themselves if they didn't do it exactly a certain way, and pulled away the actual reason behind doing it in the first place. And I just
so that can happen. You know, I think you mentioned something about people studying Kabbalah, and that can drive them crazy. Which is one of the interesting reasons why we always recommend that people shouldn't get into the esoteric and the Kabbalistic until they've mastered the simple, right? In other words, if you're a builder, don't build a penthouse before you have the foundation. So a lot of things can happen when people do things in not in the right order. People can do things with misinterpretations. They can hear sometimes a speech that will ring in their ears about how something is sinful, and it makes a tremendous impression upon them. And interestingly enough, if you ask the person who spoke, they don't remember ever intending it in that way, but it's just the way it gets interpreted. So sometimes the straightening out is a simple matter of somebody who you trust setting you straight that you've misinterpreted it or you escalated it beyond proportion. And other times it's really just a manifestation of something which is much more serious, where someone like you has to handle it. Yeah. Right.
I guess the last thing that I'd say the last piece I just want to mention is one of the things that I certainly recognize for myself, and that anecdotally I've certainly seen, is that there's something powerful within the community building of Judaism. Maybe I'm biased because I go to synagogue with you, but I must say, in terms of orthodoxy, I think of there being a brilliance to not being able to prohibition against driving on Shabbat, and when you have something like that, it means that if you want to go to synagogue, you have to live within the range of the synagogue that you could walk, which means that you are surrounded by the people that you celebrate your simchas and that are there to offer support to you when you're struggling. And that sense of community and belongingness is something certainly within my practice that I see as one of the main factors that determines treatment outcomes. When you have someone who doesn't feel they belong anywhere, they don't do very well. Now, within that, you also have the fact that within the Jewish community, within a specific community, as with any community, there are those that are the in-group and there are those that are the out-group. Sometimes the out-group are simply people who don't feel like they belong. It may not actually be grounded in something real. But then there are, you know, people form cliques and people like to invite certain people over and so forth. And that can be really tough. But the piece in terms of mental health is that when you have a mental health issue, a close-knit group can also create a sense of a lack of privacy. And so some of the people that would, for example, come and see me have been people that haven't felt safe to bring this into the community because of concern about stigma, concern about judgment. And when you think about it, if you're an Orthodox individual and maybe, you know, the people that you get together with, maybe among the people that you eventually consider to marry or communities communicating, having an issue with addictions or having an issue with mental health can be something that you may want to keep private. And so there's that double side of the incredible resilience building of a strong community and at the same time a struggle to come out in that community is having some of these struggles because of that concern about now becoming a part of the out group.
Right. Yeah, so lots of good observations there. The study of Korach, for example, is a classic instance of people who felt that they were shunted to the outside and wanted to be on the in, and basically did what we would consider to be inappropriate rebellious activity in order to become the new in people, with no indication that if they would be ruling the roost, they would do anything differently. So these challenges go back throughout history, the idea of not being where I want to be and then looking upon the community out there as stopping me from achieving my goal or whatever the case may be. On the idea of privacy is an interesting thing because today the major invasion of privacy is coming through the Ethernet. It's not coming from being in proximity. The type of junk that's going out on Facebook and I don't know, all sorts of these other things that I can't even keep up with, where people's privacy, to the point of some people committing suicide over the last number of years because they were, so to say, outed for whatever reason. I think that a close-knit community is obviously more often than not a buffer and a protector, mm-hmm. But nothing is perfect.
Right.
And you can have a perfect community and you have one outlier who then does not behave according to the community protocols and everything gets thrown out of kilter. But it doesn't take away from the fact that if you have a safe space, which is the community that you're with, then even issues such as addiction. I mean, in my time, I see that we've grown from the time that it was shashtil, don't say anything to anyone, to the point where at this stage in time there are a lot of people who say, well, these are my friends, and they make the decision that living a life of secrecy and keeping it creates the anxieties that don't make these matters better, they make them worse, and being open about it and therefore creating a community of support is the way to go. It's interesting you mentioned this thing about the driving. I can't tell you that originally when the Shabbat regulations were made that driving was in the game plan, but the truth of the matter is that the idea of going beyond the community, and even there were special things that had to be done even in biblical times to go beyond the community. Really, there was such a thing called Tuchum Shabbat, which is to say that beyond a certain area of the city, you shouldn't even venture on the Shabbat. In other words, not to be detached from the community. So we did have this sense that being in a community is important. And we know, what was it we have in the Talmud this famous statement, O chavruta, O mituta, which is to say either friendship or death. We realize that just being on your own and having no one to care for you and no one to be able to talk to about your issues is devastating.
I'll tell you, I would almost, without calling it Shabbat, there have been times I've recommended to my non-Jewish families
to try it.
On the weekend.
Do we have
no devices? Talk to each other.
Yeah.
Spend time together as a family. I mean, these are things that are really important for anybody.
Right. Modern day, you have five people driving in the car, father, mother, and the three kids, and each one is on their own phone.
That's right. Yeah. So I wonder. We have a few questions here,
okay.
And I also wondered if there are any questions that people have or comments or concerns.
Start with me. Okay, it might be a bit of a provocative question, just as a warning. Something I've been thinking about for years. We know as a Jewish people, we've had the Talmud, we've been alive, thriving for thousands of years. A lot of wisdom in the Talmud, in our Torah. My question very bluntly is, why do we need modern psychology? Apart from the chemical imbalance problems, there's so much...
I'm just joking.
Warning, you talked about the rebel, you talked about referring to the best psychologists, regardless of whether they were God-fearing or not. If the psychologist is a rabbi, is knowledgeable about the Talmud and the wisdom and the insights, then it's an obvious bonus. But why? Yeah, that's my question.
Yeah, so I would answer this from my own personal experience. There are times that over the course of the few years that I've been in the rabbinate, that people would come with issues. They were solvable, and they were solvable based on, some of the values that we imbibe that are pretty clear. But you get to a point, I had a very strict dividing line, which I'm sure the good doctor will be happy about. I said if I couldn't solve the problem with two visits, then I was referring it out. And the reason for it basically is that sometimes things are quite serious, and they're beyond our ken. Very often in marital situations, I have all of the tricks in the toolbox that can be used to get people back on the same page. Doesn't always work, but I recognize that there are some pretty darn good marriage counselors out there. Who can bring them together. It takes a lot of time. Part of it was a function of time. But we have no difficulty realizing that it's not that we're saying that the wisdom to solve the problem is not there. It's that there are people who have expertise. And let's face it, we're living in a generation where lots of these issues were not necessarily confronted beforehand. And if you have people who are expert at this, it would be a sinful not to use them, as opposed to saying, why should we? So I would say there's a breaking point at which even the best of the rabbis would have to admit, I can't cure this addiction. This fellow needs to go to someone who has some of the toolbox kits that we don't even know about. Methadone. We don't know. Yeah, we can't do that. I mean, there's some really serious stuff. So I would say that we should never look upon people who are in the business of healing as adversaries. We should always look upon them as allies.
The other thing that I would add, and thank you for that, by the way, that makes me feel closer to you.
Take away the table.
Let's take it. The other thing that I would add is you can't be everything. So, you have a limit in terms of the things that you can learn about, just like I do.
Right, absolutely.
And so I think, there's an incredible benefit to someone who can be both a rabbi and a psychologist. I don't know if you know anybody like that. But really to be able to keep up with those two very big areas is very difficult. So that's one possibility. The other thing is I think it would be a mistake to assume that coming to see a psychologist is going to be the end, that's going to be the solution. It's one piece in the puzzle. We're very complex, and so coming to see a psychologist does not mean your rabbi is now out of the picture. Certainly there's going to be that side, the religious and spiritual side, if that's a big part of what's important to you, that's going to continue to need to be nurtured, and you're not necessarily going to get that from a psychologist. So the piece that we can do to help guide and then have you go back into your community and work with your rabbi on the other pieces, it's about trying to address all the different pieces, and one person can't do that. So.
Okay.
I think we just have a few minutes left, so maybe we'll take a couple of questions on
that. Oh, okay, because they got they went out of the way to run.
Okay.
If supposed to be happy and hugging, how can we say not? How can we not be sad saying Yizkor? Great question. We say Yizkor on so the good. There's many things to say about that, but the main thing is that this came not very lightly. I'd ask another question. In the Torah, there's no sad day. How can we add in Tisha B'Av? How we add in the fast of the 17th of Tammuz? What right do we have to do that when, in fact, there is no sad day in the Torah? How can we impose that? The answer to that simply is that there are circumstances that change the reality. Even though the Torah may have hinted at it, till we were exiled from the land and we had this tragedy that we had to then seriously confront and do the right things to remedy, so we didn't have to worry about it. Yizkor is an outgrowth of crusades, pogroms, and all sorts of other ugly things that
it's December 6th at the Soloway JCC. Our building will be closing in 30 minutes and will reopen tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. We ask that all members and guests please leave the building by 10 p.m. Thank you.
Okay, so I better quickly answer. So it turns out there were controversies. A lot of people didn't like the idea. But what prevailed is that since people were coming because everyone was in shul on Yom Tov, they said this is the only time we can do it in the public setting. So overriding the obligation to be happy was this idea that we will remember. But remember, too, it's a very interesting thing. I know there's a big controversy on this. The right thing, I know there's all sorts of different views on it. Yizkor doesn't start until after the three times that the people who have been mourning have actually skipped it. And that is simply because by the time Yizkor starts, it's already a year's perspective. And in a sense, at that point in time, you have you're looking back and you say, I was terribly upset when my parents passed away, but looking back now, I'm so grateful because I had those parents. So in a way, the intensity of the day is mitigated because of it, but it is an issue, and it was handled, even though there was big debate and some people took your side in your question. Okay, over to you.
So the question that I have, I'll give you that one as well.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it's, I don't see it as a question, anxiety about kids' future, good kids, in this insecure world. So I'm not sure what the question is, but if I was to make comments on that, first of all, I'd say I probably could have written this for myself. And the important thing to keep in mind when we're dealing with anxiety is the one thing that maintains anxiety is avoidance. So whenever I have to drop off my girls, as I did today on the first day of camp at the JCC, and my little ones, 5 and 4, are scared, my instinct is I want to take away your pain, come with me, you don't have to do camp. Everything will be okay and I'll hold on to you, right? Which they'll be miserable because they'll be bored at home and so forth. It's a very important thing to encourage people to face some of their challenges. So when you're dealing with anxiety, it's important to keep in mind that your kids are looking towards you to determine, are things safe? So it becomes very important for you to manage as much as you can to get your support and do the things that you need to do to manage your anxiety. Because if they saw anxiety on me while I was dropping them off, they would become even more anxious. So we have a responsibility as well to kind of take care of our anxiety. But in terms of getting rid of that feeling, it's pretty hard to get rid of it. You care about your kids, you worry about the world that's out there, and it can be a very scary place. That's quite normal. If it's interfering with your ability to function, it's important to talk to some people and learn some strategies.
Last question. I'm sure you're happy to hear that. Last question. But it's a question for which the answer is 3 hours. Could you comment on logotherapy and the concept of the world to come as a destination? Well, let me just tell you that that could be a topic for next year, Jeff, if you want. But the point very quickly is that Frankl was the architect of logotherapy. He was one of the first who had the guts to talk about the world to come, realizing that when he's proposing the idea of the quest for meaning as being the fundamental foundation of what we're all about, that this whole idea of meaning is a very objective one, and if it's an objective meaning, it can't end with the world, so there's got to be something beyond. So he followed that trajectory and said that inevitably his entire system led to that question. And it took a lot of guts, because at that point in time he's getting pilloried even for mentioning God in a positive light. And here he is saying, I'll show you guys, not only will I mention God, I'll mention the world to come. So in many places he was dismissed because of it. But it's been interesting to see how, in fact, he understood this. And what, just my actual doctoral thesis with him is based on a discussion that I had with him on how and why he was resisting openly saying that there is such a thing as the world to come. All he did was open up the possibility, but not affirm it. And the gist of the argument was, I was pushing him to become a rabbi. He was pushing and say, I don't want to only stay as a psychologist. I'll leave the door open. You do with them once they get in the door the way you want to. So that's the 2-minute answer to the question.
So I hate to cut this short, but they're
going
to close the building.
Yeah, right.
And it's creating a lot of anxiety.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Actually, here, just a little commercial. If you're interested in anxiety, it's Friday and lunch and learn. So I don't know if I'll be away during the day, but that's my topic. And we have a little gift for Neil for coming out this evening. And we thank you so very much. Roy Volko will be back tomorrow, but we'll give him his gift.
Is that the inducement?
It's an inducement, right, to make sure you come. And of course, lunch on arrival, because lunch will learn tomorrow on Moda Ani, the prayer that we say when we wake up and first thing in the morning. And I don't know about everybody else, but I really enjoyed this. And I thank you both so much. I thought it was very stimulating and gave us a lot to think about. And now some ideas for next year. So hopefully we'll see you back again. Thank you.
I'll see you on Shabbos.
You will. And that's when I let you have the final word.
No. What?
Oh, the man going to stay from Earth.
Oh, do we have a meeting?
If everyone stays.
Okay.
I have anxiety before I ask that question.
You don't have to. One of the things that I really enjoy about you and your wife is you're not afraid to not only ask good questions, but you're open-minded enough to hear challenging ideas.
I can the same way.
Well,
So where are we dominating?
I don't know how they reconcile the punishment.
In the boardroom office.
Yeah. Thank you very
much.
Always
a pleasure.
Really enjoyed it.
It was an absolute pleasure.
So I love this pen.
You can have many. We have many.